Hello, everyone. It's student John Lovell here back again with another episode of the Book Exchange Podcast. This is episode 65. Our topic tonight is science fiction. We're going to recommend some of our favorite titles, maybe some, you know, off the beaten path titles, maybe some newer ones. We'll see. I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Mr. Jude Lovell in Pennsylvania. Jude, how are you tonight?
Doing great. Ready to get back rolling again. It's been a little while.
Yeah. We're getting our sea legs back here. I don't know, we say that often, but I don't know why. It just really does feel like it's been a while. And we've had a couple of false starts even recording this episode. So we'll see if we can get back on track. But yeah, this science fiction episode is probably one we've been talking about even on the show for at least a year. And I don't know why for me, Jude, it was kind of like this was a daunting one to try to take on because, I mean, you kept pointing out, like, any genre, you know, it's a deep, deep pool. For some reason with this one, there's so many authors I was thinking about and titles and, you know, series. And I was just, man, I had trouble getting my arms around it. But the way we're approaching it is, like I said, we're just going to recommend some of our favorite books. Maybe they're not our favorites all time, but maybe there's something interesting about them that we want to pass on to other readers and listeners. And, you know, it's just going to be kind of a how we do it, you know, sort of a hangout, you know, loosely structured hangout session where we just bat around different titles that have made an impact on us over the years. And that's how this is going to go, which is not much different from how it always goes. So, but I know you're pretty right. I know you're pretty excited about, you know, talking some science fiction tonight too.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It is. This is where you and I, you know, being identical twins, we're not always exactly the same, you know, contrary to, you know, what people might feel. And we approach topics differently. But, I mean, you're certainly right. It's a huge pool. And it's got so many, you know, it's got a really long history. And just, you know, they're like different flavors to different eras of science fiction and stuff like that. I didn't feel much pressure to kind of like really cast new light on any of that stuff. You know, for me, this was about talking about like the science fiction books that I've read over the years leading up to kind of all the way up to this episode that have like really stayed with me and why that was. So, you know, there's no effort to make like a comprehensive coverage or anything like that of the whole genre, you know, and I would argue even like you and I are, you know, We're plenty dorks, as we joke all the time, you know, like, but I don't see us like, we're not really hardcore science fiction people.
No,
you know, it's like a thing that we just keep coming back to. And part of this episode, I think we'll try to approach a little bit of why, you know, like we keep coming back to it and, you know, and maybe that's part of what it is. Cause you know, for some people it's like such a passion genre or like area of reading and stories, and you got to be like either all in or not all in. I mean, we're kind of not really like that, either you or me, but we have returned to it with this conversation, you know, that the Book Exchange Podcast is based on, you know, fairly consistently. And when we do, we kind of have a great time, you know.
That's right.
Going all the way back to like the 80s and the 90s. So we're going to cover some of that tonight, but I mean, it's just this is our riff on science fiction, I guess.
That's right. That's what it is, and that's well said. And yeah, I think when we kick off the discussion proper, we are going to talk just a little bit about, like you said, it, you know, kind of like it draws us back in from time to time, even though it's not. I think neither one of us, and you know, genres are silly in a way. But if you were forced to choose your favorite genre, whatever that means, I don't think either one of us necessarily would have science fiction as our number one favorite. But that being said, you know, we both continue to get drawn back into it, and we'll talk about why that is. So we're glad you're with us. It's another episode of the Book Exchange Podcast, and we're going to stick to the format as we often do and get, unless you have anything else you want to say, we'll get right into what we've been reading lately.
Had a few other sort of scattered thoughts, but I think we're probably going to be kind of covering them as we talk about the book. So let's just forge on.
Excuse me. Yeah. So what we like to do on this show is just kind of review what it is we're reading right now. So Jude, what would that be for you?
Oh gosh, I'm reading a book that I'm just so excited about. You know that because of the ongoing, you know, exchange.
Yeah.
Totally different, you know, genre and line of work here in fiction. Well, actually, the book I'm reading is not fiction, but has to do with fiction. So I'm reading a book. It's called The Hidden Files. It's the autobiography of a rather obscure English crime writer who probably wouldn't even call himself a crime writer, who was the most prominent, if he was prominent at all, in like the 80s, early 90s. The man's name was Robin Cook. That was his born name. But he wrote under a surname because you remember the famous medical thriller guy, Robin Cook, Coma, etc.
I do.
He was a prominent writer in the 70s and 80s. I read him when we were young, and, you know, maybe someday we'll have to, you know, throw back to some of those books. But he didn't want to be confused with that individual. So he wrote under the pen name of Derek Raymond. And his books, he only has about, I'd say, somewhere between 8 and 10 books total in his life. He lived kind of like a hard life, you know, like he was a pornographer for a long while. He was English. He worked a lot of odd jobs, like at these, and he was kind of like a rabble rouser on the streets. And he worked as a taxi driver in London for several years and ended up kind of writing these, what you would call crime novels, but he calls them, and talks very much in this book called The Hidden Files, he calls them black novels, which is his crime novels that he wrote. The most famous books that he wrote is a series of five, I'm going to say crime novels, or novels about police and investigations of terrible crimes in kind of the underworld of London. Five books, it's called the Factory series. And those are still in print, but they're not very easy to find. And most of his other books are not really in print, including The Hidden Files. I actually had to go out and find this, and I paid like more than I normally would. But I was just so interested in Derek Raymond. I think we're going to talk sometime in the future about Derek Raymond, because his black novels, his crime novels set in England in the Thatcher era 1980s are just extraordinary books. For many, many reasons. You and I have talked about them many, many times. John, I'm just going to cancel this beeping.
Sure.
So we don't get that.
Yep.
Sorry. Yep. Anyway, the Factory series and Derek Raymond's work is practically worth its own podcast. We've talked about it before. Yeah. The Hidden Files, which is a title I'm just totally in love with. I just think it's fantastic. It's an autobiography, and I won't go on too long about it, but it's where Derek Raymond lays out kind of his life story, talks about how he got to a place where he was writing these extremely bleak but devastatingly powerful crime novels set in the 80s that were just these mirrors held up to a kind of degraded and lost society. You know, both with the crimes that were committed in the books and then the treachery and the corruption around the people investigating them and what led to the crimes. These books are very, very bleak and very hard to read in a way, but they're extraordinary examples of like realism and truth telling in fiction. And The Hidden Files is where he explains how he got to write these novels and why he pursues the writing that he pursues and what his philosophy is on the black novel and where it comes from. And it is just absolutely fascinating. He was an incredible writer who should have way more admirers than he ever had. He died a long time ago. And so, I'll leave it there. I'm kind of ripping through this book. I'm very glad that I found it. I was looking for it for years. I paid extra money for it in a mass market paperback that was produced in the 90s. I'm so glad I did that. I think it's worth every word and every penny. And like I've said to you offline, I'm definitely going to share it with you. So that's what I'm on, The Hidden Files. I can't, you know, I'm getting close to the end, but I kind of don't want it to end. It's really, it's quite a book.
Yeah, that's such an awesome title. I mean, for yeah. And I'm sure for more reasons than I know. But yeah, we are definitely gonna do an episode on Derek Raymond and specifically on the Factory Series sometime.
I think we have to.
Sometime in the future. Yeah. So Jude has already shared with me that he is gonna share this book, so I'm gonna get a chance to read it too, thanks to you going out and doing the legwork and finding it. So we'll get much more into Derek Raymond, but you know, I agree, of course. You know, he after you've read a couple of the Factory books, assuming you have the stomach for them, because they are rough. If you're a fan of, like, you know, there's no other way to say it. Like you said, like crime fiction, especially, you know, of the dingy or dirty variety, then you would definitely be a fan of these books. But you know, it's much more than just the subject matter. It's the way he writes them, but you know, that's for a future episode. But he's also,
yeah, and that, John, can I interrupt you for a second? I'm sorry to do that.
Go ahead.
There was just one more thing I wanted to add is in this book, he also takes some very acerbic in his style. Once you get to know his style, shots at some real sacred cows. He's talking about old ladies, you know, kind of running around the trains of England, solving mysteries, and the dapper, you know, secret agent who goes around, you know, solving other mysteries with what he calls, in the really remarkable word choice in the book, The Hidden Files, with bowdlerized women at his side. You know, so he takes shots at, like, the titans of, you know, like Agatha Christie, James Bond, and stuff like that. So it's like, it's kind of delicious in a way. So I did want to mention that.
Yeah. What I was going to say was that, you know, he's I agree with you. He's severely underread, but at the same time, you also feel when you do find a writer like that, or same thing for musicians, you know, people or bands, you find a band that, like, not a whole lot of people know about. You kind of feel like you're in sort of a secret club.
Oh, yeah. Ain't that the truth? You're right.
Yeah. Like, you know. And it's just like that with Derek Raymond, because he still does not have a wide readership. But you start reading, you read one of the Factory books, and you're like, I got to read this whole series. It's incredible. But anyway, that's a great one. And what I'm reading, I actually just finished. I'm cheating by mentioning what I just finished, but I think it's worth mentioning. I just finished a very famous collection of short stories from about 25 years ago, maybe. That won the Pulitzer Prize at the time when it came out as a debut collection from an Indian American writer named Jhumpa Lahiri. And it was her debut book of short stories called Interpreter of Maladies. And I just finished that. And it's a book that's been on my shelf for years and years. And for whatever reason, I just decided to pick it up and read it. And I'm really glad that I did. It's excellent. It's very nuanced, and it each story kind of sheds some kind of light on primarily the experience of Indian immigrants coming to live in the United States, or in one case, living in England and then the United States. So it's about people from India, and some of the stories actually take place in India, but the majority of them take place in the United States. But each of them shows some sort of different aspect of Indian culture, and they're just fascinating. So that's a great, great book. I hope someday you'll get to that, because that's a tip of the hat of how we like to read internationally on this show.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always heard about it, so I'd like to fit it in.
Yeah. It's really, they're really well written, very much worth your time. So it's always fun to kind of, you know, introduce yourself to a widely acclaimed writer that you didn't know anything about. But so after that, because I always like to take like a wicked turn after I read whatever, and I'm going back to, this is, I don't even know if this is its own genre, but it is for me, the office novel or the office comedy, you know. I think we've done an episode where we talked about books that have to do with work. So I think on that episode, we talked some about some books that are set within an office, I believe. Right. Yeah. So this is another one of those. It's one that's, again, it's been on my shelf for a while. Again, it's a debut. This one, and this time it's a novel. It's a book by a novelist named Ed Park. And the book is called Personal Days, hilariously. And It's just kind of, it's like sort of a comedy that's set in an office building. And strangely enough, there's another book like this that we've talked about on the show before that largely takes place in an office, and it's called Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris. And can you still hear me?
I can.
Yeah. One of the things that's very distinctive about that book, Then We Came to the End, is that it's written in this, in the kind of first person plural. So it's like, we did this, we did that, you know,
right.
So you're kind of talking about all the people or a group of people who work in the same office. This novel uses this exact same conceit. So it's written in that same voice, which I thought was sort of interesting. But it's early on, but it's very, very funny. And it just seems to be, you know, a novel about a group of people all who work for this nameless company in Manhattan, and kind of like basically about the drudgery and the, like the mundane aspects of their lives working in this office. But it was written back in 2008. So some of the references are a little dated, but so far I'm really enjoying it, but I'm not that far into it. So I can't even say that much beyond what I've already said, but, I've always enjoyed a good office satire or a comedy set in an office, whether it's a movie or a book or a TV series. I think a lot of people relate to those just from having worked in various offices. So I'm getting a kick out of it so far, but it's early.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a book that I think came out like somewhere in the same neighborhood as Then We Came to the End and kind of made a little bit of a splash. And then, like I was seeing the offline, that writer kind of disappeared. Ed Park is the name of the writer. I can't remember if you said that or not, but you might have.
Yeah, I think I did.
Okay. And then he recently came out with a new novel that's wildly different, but we're not going to really talk about that. But anyway, it was interesting that he kind of went away for a long time and then came out with a second book. But, yeah, that was a book that kind of made a splash, and I haven't read it, but it's probably funny, and, you know, you and I have been through our fair share of office drudgery, so and it's a great zag from Interpretive Maladies. So good job to you.
Yeah, it's always fun to do that, and, you know, I thought it would just be a little bit lighter, and so far it's a lot of fun. So
I bet, yeah.
So unless there's nothing else, then we're going to take another, you know, sharp left turn, and we're going to get into the world of science fiction.
All right, let's blast off, you know.
Exactly. To infinity, come on. To infinity and beyond, as one of the Pixar movies puts it, Jude. And I know you're a huge fan of those Pixar movies. So,
yeah, not as much as others, but that's okay.
Now, but do you happen to know what movie that quote is from, To Infinity and Beyond?
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay,
that's, so. You know, part of the lexicon.
Little Buzz Lightyear there.
Yeah, I mean, I've taken my kids when they were little to Disney, so, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You get enough of that, so, like. Yeah.
Well, okay, so what we've done, we've each, as we tend to do sometimes with these genre shows on the Book Exchange podcast, we've each chosen a list of about five titles. We might tweak it a little bit here and there. That we want to share with the listeners and just talk about why we really appreciate these books, why they've stayed with us, as Jude, you already said. But why don't we just start, you know, kind of, this is not really a curveball or a surprise, but you mentioned before how this is a genre that, even though it may not be, you know, there's some people who kind of like read almost exclusively in one genre. I was talking to a guy recently and I mentioned to him that we were going to do a show on science fiction, and he's like, that should be pretty cool. And I said, are you a fan? I mean, do you read? He's like, no, I'm basically a fantasy guy. And the way he described himself, it's like almost as if, I'm sure this isn't true, but he's like, I read fantasy, you know, and that's kind of what I do, which I thought was kind of interesting, because we're sort of, as everybody knows who's listening to this, we're sort of the exact opposite on this show. Like we don't read any one thing, no matter what it is, you know. Try to read everything we can get our hands on. But you did say that science fiction, and this is true of both of us, you know, we kind of wind our way back there. We kind of regularly kind of drawn back into that world or that type of writing. And I think we should unpack just brief, try to keep it brief, because we could go on and on just about this question, you know, why that is. I know even just earlier this year, you know, you talked on the show about, what was it? The Kraken Awakes by John Wyndham, who's one of the famous, you know, British science fiction writers, and how much you enjoyed that book. What do you think it is? And this is tough because science fiction covers so much, but what do you think it is that keeps you coming back to these types of books?
Oh, I think, you know,
I have a thought about it. If you want to collect your thoughts.
Well, I can take a shot, but if you want to start it off, go ahead.
No. If you're ready to take a shot, please do.
Well, in a word, fun, you know, I was starting to say when in the intro, and, you know, was going to continue in that vein a little bit in the rest of the show. Like, yes, you and I tend to come back to it. I'd say since like the late 80s, early 1990s. And when we do, there's a lot of laughing and we have a good time with it. And I think that's part of it. I'm not saying we don't have a good time with other genres, but we just talked about the black novel and crime novels. We both enjoy talking about that and stuff like that. But you don't go there for like a good time.
No.
You know, fantasy, maybe. A fantasy is, you know, a little bit different. You know, like, we're not talking about that today. But, and I think part of it can be found in that, you know, some kind of riff also on that old, the classic old intro to the Star Trek series, you know, like to explore new worlds and civilizations and boldly go where no one has gone before. That's what science fiction does, you know?
Right.
And it just kind of imagines a world beyond ours. And I think that's really fun. For us, it's really fun. And I find that very fun and interesting as a reader. And then a third thing I would say before I kick it to you is, for me personally, again, I tend to come back to, you know, creating worlds myself and writing fiction and so forth and being a big fiction person anyway. I also find it's very fertile ground for like the imagination. That's kind of obvious because you have to like kind of come up with, you know, construct out of nothing everything that happens in a sci-fi novel that either, you know, out of something we know plausibly could be true or whatever. It's often set in the future and it's just a real vehicle for a wildly running amok imagination. And I personally really like that. And I respond to it. You know, that's where these books tend to have like just totally bananas ideas, you know?
Yeah, they really do. Yep. And that, if you're finished.
Yeah.
That's a nice segue into why I think I keep coming back to it, because on top of everything you just said, it's just, you know, the imagination, the fun, you know, the speculation. You know, what if we could go out to the farthest reaches of space? What if we could travel through time? You know, what if we could conquer death? That kind of thing. You know, all these questions that everybody wonders about, you know, in their life at some point. To me, I sort of realized too that, you know, as you know, and by now most people who have listened to this show know that there's a couple areas of reading that I always respond to, and they're just personal interests of mine. And you know, if there's anything to do with one of these two things in a book I'm reading, I'm always a little bit more interested. And one of those is theology or religion, spirituality, or the big questions around God and faith. And the other strand that always kind of grabs my attention is anything having to do with technology. So, you know, science fiction, more than any other genre, brings those two things together almost every time, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's good. That's well said. Yep.
Yeah. So like, I realize, like, you know, because I'm so interested in questions around those two areas, it's almost always a rich experience to read a good science fiction book, because they always touch up about, if they're not touching up on big questions of faith, and they often are, but even if they're not, they're touching against the borders of what we know and going past that into what we don't know, and the realm of the unknown, the realm of mystery, what's beyond the edges of the universe, what's beyond our current, you know, reservoir of scientific knowledge, what's beyond our lives, that kind of thing. And then, as I said, it also, because you're looking to the future often in science fiction, it often involves, you know, technology is either real or imagined. So these are all reasons for me why I continue to find the genre of science fiction so interesting and fascinating. So those are just some. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was further going to say, like, it's such a I lost my train of thought a little bit, but like it's quite an. Oh, I was going to the point I wanted to make, and it's almost always, at least when it's done right, I guess, it's almost always a rollicking good time in the process.
That's right.
Yeah. So you're kind of confronting these big, vast, either questions or landscapes, possibilities, for lack of a better word, you know, in the story. You got to kind of make it plausible. You got to make it fun. And so it's really quite an art form, because when it's maybe we'll talk about this a little, but we've run into, you know, science fiction that's not memorable. Sometimes it's like, it's too science, you know, or it's so hard science. You can't even, you know, the average person can't understand what the hell they're talking about. You know, if you start to get into like, you know, quantum physics and equations and stuff like that. So a science fiction writer has to be able to navigate that and not make it just really boring. You know, and most of the time, like at least the ones that we're going to talk about today where they really stood out to us, they were like, you know, rousing good times at the same time. So it's quite an art form. It's quite a form, you know.
Yeah, you see it come up again and again. I mean, we're not really going to get deep into this particular book, but, you know, in recent years, you had a book and then a movie called The Martian by a guy named Andy Weir, who and that was just – the premise of that book was so compelling. It was just, you know, there's a mission to Mars. Somehow one crew member gets you know, separated from the rest of the mission, and the mission leaves, and he's stuck on the planet. Now he's got to figure out, basically using his brains and science, how to survive until they come back, which is a couple years or whatever. I mean – That's the setup, and I think that was that both the book and the movie were just a huge hit, and I think it's because, I don't know many people who wouldn't find that setup interesting and want to know, well, how did he do it? You know, so
yeah, what happened?
Andy Weir, I've read him before. He's not a great writer by any stretch of the imagination, but he knows the science, and he's able just enough to keep the story, you know, propulsive and moving forward, so that you get the answers to those questions that you want to get. But that's just a recent example of something that really, I mean, a lot of people read that book and saw that movie and really liked it. So there's just something compelling about it.
Yeah.
So that being said, you know, we're going to recommend some titles that are among our personal favorites. Jude, what's the first book that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I'm actually cheating on two. So I have five. Titles, quote unquote, that I want to talk about. I'm cheating on like the first two though. And I told you offline before we started this because I didn't mention to you that I came up with five and you did also, I believe, you know, it's kind of like our main selections. What I decided to do that I didn't tell you I was going to do was I decided just for fun, I was going to, my books, not yours necessarily, but my books I'm going to talk about are in chronological order based on when I came upon them in life. I just decided it might be fun to do that.
Okay.
So I think, so I'm going to start off by talking, and not only am I cheating by talking about a series of books instead of just one book, but it's also something that has come up before. So hopefully I, you know, don't spend too much time on my first one, but I have to talk about the Dune books, you know, Frank Herbert's Dune series. We talked about it, I think, more than once in episodes before. But this is the first that I can think of. I, you know, my memory stinks, but this is the earliest that I got into, quote, straight up science fiction books was the Dune series, which I read. Oh man, I'm trying to remember, John, but it was definitely in the 80s when I was a teenager. And I think it had to do with, I honestly don't know if, so you and I are old enough to remember the famous David Lynch film version of Dune that came out in the 80s with Sting. We were big police fans and Kyle MacLachlan, and, you know, it was kind of a big train wreck, that movie.
Yeah.
You know, David Lynch's version of Dune. But I remember it being huge at the time, and I remember seeing it at Berkeley Cinema when I was a kid with you. You were probably there, you know, like on the big screen. And I remember, you know, it being like basically followable for about 20 minutes. And then it just like, you know, went off into incomprehensibility. But that was based on the Dune series of books by Frank Herbert, most famously the original book Dune, which I've discussed from 1965, that led to a whole series of seven novels that Frank Herbert produced set in this world around the desert planet of Arrakis. And Paul Atreides is like this, you know, like a sort of prophesied, almost a messiah figure that is kind of young and just starting out in the first Dune book. And it tells the story of his rise to power and how he becomes kind of like the emperor of that galaxy and whatever in the first book of Dune. And then it goes on from there. And I read Dune. I was really, I felt ambitious to try to go through the whole series. I think I made it to the third book, which is called Children of Dune. And I have only vague memories of the third book, John, but like it really got weird. You know, I remember Paul Atreides kind of turning into one of those sandworms, you know, on the Arrakis, and like, you know, just becoming this like mythological figure, and it really got weird. So
hate it when that happens.
I just have vague memories of, you know, not being able to keep up with the length of my ambition, you know, as a teenager. But I guess what I want to say about the Dune books is that, and I recently, you know, a few years back, I reread Dune, really loved it. I was totally amazed by its complexity. It's a very complex story with all kinds of characters and layers and politics in it. It was way over my head as a teenager, you know, but rediscovering it as a, you know, like a 40-something-year-old man was really something, and you could really admire the achievement of the original book Dune. Again, all crafted out of one imagination, you know, kind of really a spellbinding story that created this entire universe. It was like kind of like, you know, exhibit A for me in like world building is Dune, you know, and that whole desert planet and
yeah,
the spice and the worms and all that kind of stuff. And then I reread Dune Messiah, which was the second book that, if you remember in our very last episode prior to this one, that was like number 10 on my best books of the year. I was really impressed with that sequel, which came out in 1969 to the original Dune. It was much shorter and it took the story into some really interesting directions. And so now I have the book Children of Dune kind of right in front of me, actually planning to read that. And then I kind of just want to go down the rabbit hole of the weird and see where it goes, at least to the end of the books that were originally written by Frank Herbert. You know, his son kind of picked it up and ran with it after that for many years. I'm not too sure if I'm interested in that, but it is an amazing saga in terms of its complex worlds. There's a great deal of politics. There's backstabbing. There's incredible ideas, you know, like that this like commodity of this rich spice that's mined on this desert planet, and whoever has control of the planet has control of the commodity. So big kind of complex ideas about international relations and you know, the shifting, I guess, tectonic plates of power, you know, between these different, like, you know, the empires and there's one whole community of, like, you know, sort of underground kind of like a proletariat on the desert planet that rises up and kind of refuses to be sort of cowed by the whole vast empire. It's just a really, you know, rich, deep, intelligent science fiction saga. So I know I'm just painting with broad strokes, but it really made an impression on me as a teenager. I couldn't really handle it at the time, but it's like really a seminal science fiction book for me, Dune. And then hopefully I'll get through the rest of the series. So that's my first one.
Yeah, that's a whopper. That's one of the great science fiction series of all times. Although it makes me at least want to mention, you know, like a series like that would not exist without, I think, you know, like the kind of like grandfather of all sort of modern science fiction. You know, there are earlier examples of what could be called science fiction, but Isaac Asimov and his Foundation series. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you can still hear me. I'm getting a little bit of an echo.
I can hear you.
Has this has this, you know, equal, has this kind of ambition where you're, it's about world building over years and years and years. I mean, that's an example of somebody like he was a hard scientist. He was a, I think a, like a scientist and engineer, but he was, he read, what is Edward Gibbon's, you know, what's the famous book, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And he mm-hmm. kind of had this grand vision that he wanted to basically rewrite that, but set it way in the future and space, you know? So the, like the Foundation series covers like 30,000 years of history and, you know, the rise and fall of this, you know, galactic empire, and how the main character is sort of like secretly keeping a storehouse of all like human knowledge that's in this unknown location somewhere else in the galaxy. So that when the inevitable, you know, rise and then fall of the galactic empire happens, they will have enough knowledge to be able to, the knowledge would serve as a quote unquote second foundation so that they could rebuild society, you know. But this is like the arc of, that these books take on, and it goes across like, you know, multiple thousands of years. So, you know, it's just Dune kind of falls within that tradition. But when you're, you know, with world building at that level, is just, it takes a spectacular imagination and vision and talent. And so, you know, there's a reason why Dune is still being read. And in fact, you know, the whole world is looking forward to, you know, the second Dune movie, because that story just lives on, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that movie is only the second part of the original novel.
Yeah.
You know, crazy. Like, and it's a vast, you know, if you've ever seen the recent Dune movie, you can see how vast the scale is. And again, for me, it's like, it's just this, how impressive it is to me that, you know, somebody created this whole, it's a little bit like the fantasy landscape with George R.R. Martin and Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
It's just, part of it is just the size and the scale.
Right.
You know, just incredible, you know?
And my first example, the book that almost, the first book that comes to mind when I think about science fiction that stayed with me, it actually sort of, it's not, you know, I don't think there's a grand vision for making this story go on and on through several books, but that's kind of where it eventually went. You know, it spawned many, many sequels, not just from the original writer, but I think people are still writing sequels to this original novel. But the original novel, which is a book called Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card,
mm-hmm.
is to me absolutely one of the most memorable, you know, science fiction stories I've ever read. And it just, I read it when I was a young man. I've always remembered it, not in its exact detail, but in the broad strokes. And it still strikes me when I think about it as one of the most fascinating and kind of powerful science fiction stories that I've ever read. And I'm sure you remember it, right? I know you've read it.
Yeah, I totally remember it from the first time I read it in, like, I'd say the early 90s or maybe early 90s college or something like that. But then I guess about five or six years ago, you gave it to my son, and he wanted me to read it to him. So I read it to both my sons over several weeks.
That's great.
So I read it not too long ago again, you know.
It's just, I mean, if anybody out there who's at all interested in science fiction hasn't read Ender's Game, you got to read it. I mean, it's an incredible story.
Agreed.
It's set in the future, and there's the protagonist is named Andrew Wiggin. He eventually kind of earns the nickname of Ender. So, but he's kind of this prodigy, and I think he might be a prodigy in like video games and things like that. But and he's got this sister named Valentine that he's very, very close to. They have this really interesting relationship. And they're almost like, I can't remember if they're twins or not, but they sort of function as twins. They're almost like connected on a mental or spiritual level.
Right.
But the Earth has been is under threat of invasion from another species that's, you know, outside of our solar system, and they're threatening to invade the Earth. And, you know, I think in an outpost out in space, I mean, my memories are vague, but we're sort of engaged in kind of like warfare with this with this other species, which they're called the buggers. That's like the nickname for this species. And basically there's this military program that takes young people who are prodigies and like certain times of like strategy type video games and recruits them into like an academy where they're trying to teach them how to eventually go to space and fight this other race so that they can save, you know, the Earth. And so Ender ends up getting recruited, and it's a story of how he kind of becomes this sort of prodigy within this like academy. And he's like, his skill level is off the charts. It's like nothing they've ever seen. And they kind of realize that he's going to be the guy who's eventually going to, you know, lead a mission to try to like take the offensive against this species. And, you know, I'm on the, if you've never read it, you might want to pause there, but, you know, maybe I shouldn't spoil it actually, but you know, it's basically the story of his training, but you come to realize that eventually he's going to find himself in a real world situation where he has to like lead this attack against this other species. But the way that, you know, it's such an interesting sort of exploration of like the way this kid is manipulated, but also the way that his thinking, his strategic thinking almost from a military perspective, but then the way he starts thinking about the relationship between humanity and this other species and, you know, how important that might be. And, you know, there's a thread of kind of, I don't know what the word is, but like almost like compassion in the book. I'm kind of dancing around it because I decided I don't really want to spoil the way this book ends, but it has an absolute whopper of an ending. But this is just – it's just a riveting story, and I remember it drawing me in, and I also remember the way the book concludes is something that I didn't really see coming, and it has this stunning conclusion that leads to other books. But, I mean – it was one of the early examples of a book that kind of like, you know, when I finished it, I was like, oh, I practically dropped the book. You know, I was like, oh man, the ending of this, I mean, the stakes couldn't be higher and the ending is just such a huge whopper and it's kind of a twist ending and it's incredible. And the book has a very thoughtful way about it. And it touches on a lot of questions about, you know, that we might be up against if we ever come into contact with another species. So it's a fascinating book, Ender's Game. And as I said, it led to about six or seven different sequels. And I remember reading there was a trilogy and then it just kind of kept going as these things do. But I remember reading the other two books after Ender's Game, but none of them had the same impact of Ender's Game, but it's just a fascinating book. And, you know, Jude, you might even remember because having served in the Army, you know, like it actually kind of has some stuff in there about, it's a little bit like Starship Troopers maybe, you know, and actually has some stuff in there about like military tactics and stuff. And so there's a lot of interesting aspects to that book, but it's the ending that really, the ending is just a whopper. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the books that, you know, kind of, you know, when you talk about sort of the mother of all twists, you know, like the film The Sixth Sense or something like that.
Right.
You know, Ender's Game is a fairly early example of, at least in our lives, of, you know, one of those types of shocks at the end that, you know, you could have seen coming, but it was very, very carefully and really beautifully calibrated by this writer, Orson Scott Card, that you didn't catch it. And when it hits, it has all the impact that, you know, that you were describing, you know, like dropping the book kind of thing. And it's always just so impressive when a book does that. And it's so memorable, you know, like it was definitely on my list. I just thought that you were probably going to talk about it, which you did, but you don't forget it, you know, like the first time you read that book, that's for sure.
Yeah. And it's really, there's no way to really describe this unless you immerse yourself in the book, but it's kind of a profound book too, because I touched on this a little bit, but it's like, it really, I think, convincingly kind of like tracks and traces an awakening of a conscience in the main character, this young kid. First, it's all fun and games, and he kind of realizes, because he's a very smart individual, he kind of realizes what this is all about and what's at stake. And you kind of like, experience the opening up of his conscience and his like inner eyes. And then there's I remember there's an aspect of the book where he and his sister are writing to each other, and those letters are kind of poignant too. And they get into some of the, you know, more philosophical questions that are floating around in the book. So that the book is not, it's not just an action story. It's really thoughtful and very well written too. So it's a high recommendation from me.
Yeah, that's very well said. It does have all those facets in it, and it has, which can't be easy to do, just to kind of capture the sort of emergent, you know, one of the really fascinating things is how you can see Ender, you know, sort of putting the pieces together, but he's just, because of where he is in life, because of his youth, he's just, he's not there yet to be able to connect all the dots. And right, the people that are running the academy are taking full advantage of that, you know, that exact quality. You know, and basically, you know, shaping it towards whatever they, it is that they want to do, you know, and it's kind of a race between Ender's, you know, sort of coming to the light, or, you know, like realizing what's going on, versus these people kind of like training him to do this and that, you know.
Yeah,
and all these things are accomplished in this, like, again, science fiction genre that's like a hopping good time, etc. So, like.
Yeah, so that's – anyway, those are two great books, or two great series really to kick us off. What do you have next?
Well, this is the hard one to keep in a small bottle, John. But so it was really interesting when I was putting my list together, because I have lots of titles, and, you know, maybe a few of them I'll rattle off at the end. But I as I was doing this, you know, I'm going to say something tonight that you've never heard me say and I don't think I've ever said in my life, you know. Which is, I realized that for me, kind of the golden age of science fiction for me personally was the 1990s. And I never put the 1990s high on any list of anything. You know, like,
that's true.
Like, I think that, I'm sorry to everybody, I'm going to piss off. The music sucks. You know, like, the culture sucked, Friends. You know, the Clinton White House. You know, like, the 1990s for you and me, like, we're too old to have sort of come of age in the 1990s, right? So we were coming up in the 80s, which the 80s culture is far superior, as everybody knows.
Everybody,
you know, like,
knows.
Sure. And for me personally, the 1990s was my 20s, and that was not the most harmonious and funnest decade of my life. I would not go back and live a lot of that entire decade. And that was the 90s for me. You and I were born in 1970. But for some reason, John, the 1990s, as far as my sci-fi experience, was like the golden age, because most of the rest of my books actually came, like, they were kind of bottled up in the middle here. I have one at the end that's more contemporary, but the other three or four are all bottlenecked around the early 1990s for whatever reason.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, because, you know, I never would have thought that I would say something like that. So actually, the next three for me are all kind of – I discovered them all in the same area. So we're talking about somewhere between 1991 and 1994. But the next book I want to talk about, you actually just brought up, and it's called Starship Troopers.
Oh, nice.
By Robert Heinlein. Now, this is definitely a seminal science fiction book for me, but it's also kind of the foggiest. You know, even with the Dune series, I read it early in the 1990s. And I wanted to mention it for a couple reasons. Like, number one, this is and I haven't reread it, and I really want to reread it. In fact, Robert Heinlein was a very famous science fiction writer, but Starship Troopers goes all the way back to 1950s. Came out in 1959. And I read it in maybe 1992, and I don't remember it really well. But I knew I had to bring it up because it obviously, it does stick out in my memory. I'm calling it a seminal science fiction title. I don't remember the plot details that well. And unfortunately, there was that dismal movie made by Paul Verhoeven in 1997, which was violent and was a totally different take on the original science fiction novel. It was more of a satirical take, and he did that on purpose. But that's like a pretty crappy movie. You know, so it's not – I'm talking about the novel. I'm definitely not talking about the movie Starship Troopers. But Anyway, because I don't remember a lot of the details, I can't go on about it at length. The reason I'm bringing it up is because, first of all, it's a representative, and I thought that this was appropriate of like the really, I just use the term golden age, but like the, some would argue that like the real golden years or the golden age of science fiction was like the 50s, you know?
Oh, yeah.
50s and like 60s. You know, flying saucers and UFOs and all that stuff. You know, like guys in like silver suits with like a domed hat and
little green men.
Yeah, take me to your leader.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a representative of that era, and I'm not very steeped in classic science fiction. I can't talk about it with any erudition, but the way that I got to it is worth bringing up. So as you know, and I've said on this podcast, when I graduated from college in 1992, I went straight into the U.S. infantry, and I served in the Army for 4 years, and the first 6 months that I was in the Army, I was attending what was called at the time, something different now, but it was called IOBC. I'll never forget it. 6 months long, and it was infantry officers' basic course where they were training me and my classmates to be infantry platoon leaders, small, light infantry platoon leaders, about 25 or 30 men. And we spent 6 months trying to learn that job. And in that course, which was not very fun to go through for me, and I wasn't very good at it, but in that course, we were actually assigned to read the novel Starship Troopers as like part of our like military education, because Starship Troopers is about like these, it's a very militaristic, it's set about 700 years in the future among infantry. And there's like I remember there was a, what do you call it? Like the little quote at the beginning. I always forget the word, epigram or of the book, that was something about the infantry. Like we're the bloody infantry. We're, you know, out on the front line, something like that. I remember that because I remember reading it as an infantry, you know, officer and saying, oh, okay, well now I know why I'm reading this, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't remember a lot of the plot details. It imagined this future United States militaristic intergalactic force that was extremely powerful, like World War II level, you know, size and scope. And they were going to different outposts in the galaxy to fight these like bug-like aliens, you know. And I think, you were talking about the buggers in Ender's Game, and I think that's kind of almost a direct descendant of Starship Troopers. Mm-hmm. And the book basically just tells about these young men that are going through a very similar course to the IOBC, but set 700 years in the future, and training to go on these combat missions against these bug-like creatures on different planets. And that's kind of what the book is about. But it's a very aggressively pro-military, pro-discipline, I don't want to say pro-warfare, but pro-military, pro-nationalism type of book. It's a large scale book. It's like something like 500 pages. There's like a main character and the guy who's going through like training, just like I was at the time. But what remains with me is how like serious Starship Troopers was about presenting the combat in realistic terms, even though it was intergalactic and against these bug-like aliens. So you had like really detailed scenes with tactics and fighting and strategy and briefings and, you know, loss of life and stuff like that, all kind of in the name of forging these young men to be leaders of other young men to defend the, not only the United States, but like kind of the whole galaxy. So I'll leave it there. Very old school. It's the type of thing that hasn't aged well. People would probably associate it with like, you know, MAGA or something like that now, you know, like, you know, very pro-American. It was sort of famously written as a response to what Robert Heinlein thought was like the softening of the post-World War II generation. You know, the guys who didn't go fight against the Nazis in Europe and stuff like that. And this was his commentary on young people, basically, and, you know, whether they had like the mettle to be leaders, etc. Huh. And so it wouldn't appeal to a lot of people maybe for that reason, but it made a big impression on me. It was really interesting to read in the context of why I personally read it. And so for those reasons, it really stands out in my mind. I had to bring it up. And also just I would really like to revisit it. Be interesting to go back and read a book from that era of science fiction. So That's what I'd say. Have you ever read Starship Troopers?
No, I've actually never read anything by Robert Heinlein, believe it or not. I know you've read more than just that.
I have, although I thought I had read the novel Stranger in a Strange Land, and I guess I haven't. But I've read other Heinlein works for sure.
Well, he's kind of like, if not on the Mount Rushmore, he's kind of like right up there among the great American, you know, classic science fiction writers. I've already mentioned Isaac Asimov. Arthur C. Clarke is another one.
Well, he might be. Yeah, that's right.
He might be British. Is he British or American? Anyway, I think.
Oh, gosh. I want to say American, but I'm not.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure. But like Robert Heinlein, you know, Ray Bradbury, you know, with the Martian Chronicles.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Anyway.
Classic sci-fi, you know.
Yeah, but it's really interesting that was actually assigned to you in the infantry. I remember that, of course. I remember hearing about that, and I remember, you know, only a few years later when the movie came out, I believe in the late 90s. And yeah. Sounds nothing like – I mean, it does have some of the – in the beginning, some of the, like, infantry – I guess aspects of it, but it's really, I think the movie's kind of, you said it was wretched, but I think it's kind of enjoyable, but it's definitely sort of sleazy.
No, totally. Yeah, no, it's fun to watch, but it's just not very, you know, one imagines Robert Heinlein being like, what the hell is this?
Paul Verhoeven. You know,
the guy took it and made it like a commentary against what Heinlein was really doing, which is interesting also, but
yeah, like, that is. And he's sort of a subversive filmmaker, but,
yeah, so that's for sure.
I don't know much about Heinlein, and I certainly don't know much about serving in the infantry or in the military. So we'll move on, but that's a great one. I mean, I'm glad you brought it up because it was sort of seminal in your young adult life.
But, right.
I meant to say a lot earlier, you know, you could almost like, we could, obviously science fiction, you could have a whole series of podcasts about, but like, you could almost divide this discussion up and it would take too long to do so. But, you know, there's like most people, there's like science fiction. You almost want to divide it in between like space science fiction and not space science fiction. You know what I mean? Because like a lot of science fiction is about going out to the stars, is about confronting other alien civilizations, is about, you know, expanding, you know, humanity's imprint into space. And there's so much of that. But there's tons of other science fiction that is just speculative about the future of the human race that doesn't necessarily have to do with space. Or it doesn't even have to be the future necessarily. It could just be, you know, questions around, you know, technology or the human condition. You know, so, you know, the next example I want to bring up is like that. And it also happens to be from the 1990s. And I also don't have the greatest memory of it, but it's one of the titles that came rushing back to my mind. And it has nothing. This one is the first one we've really discussed that doesn't have anything to do with going out into space or confronting aliens or anything like that. And this is more, you know, set in the future. And it's kind of speculative science fiction as to where the human race will go when our technologies have developed. And you might know where I'm going with this, Jude. So this is not the book I'm going to discuss, but there's a very famous book that was kind of seminal in the early, I think in the 1980s, by William Gibson called Neuromancer.
Right.
And that's another one that we could talk about that I did read, but I don't remember very much about. But in the 1990s, you know, there's a writer that emerged that I think is still writing today. He's kind of known for writing these huge, massive, like, doorstop books that, you know, mix in all kinds of strange ideas. And his name is Neal Stephenson. And he wrote a book called Snow Crash. And that's a book that I remember very vividly reading. I don't remember a ton of the plot, but I remember very vividly reading that book and being kind of blown away by some of the ideas in it. But also like kind of like flummoxed and confused by how complicated the plot was. And I think you read Snow Crash as well, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
But
that was one we bonded over and shared and laughed a lot about. You know, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Snow Crash was one of those.
Oh, yeah. It just, I had to bring it up because this is a book, I believe it came out in something like 1992 or something in the early 90s. But it's so, you know, it envisioned a future and it predicted so many things that we're seeing now. A huge example of which is called the metaverse. Like, I think I don't know if he coined the term metaverse, but he was definitely the first guy to popularize that idea, which is now becoming a huge thing in technology. You know, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, renamed his company Meta, you know, basically because he believes that's so much of the future is heading in this direction of, you know, this quote unquote metaverse. Well, this is the metaverse, which is kind of like this, you know, alternate universe you can exist in. Sort of in a disembodied digital way, you know, is something that is a major part of the plot of this book, Snow Crash. And along with that, he envisioned this idea that you would have an avatar that would be kind of like your person, but in this digital metaverse. So, I mean, like he was writing about this stuff in the early 90s. And even he said when this book came out, you know, like the internet existed, but people didn't use it. It wasn't like you remember the early 90s. Like we weren't on the internet. You know, we didn't have access to that stuff yet.
Right.
So Stevenson invented this incredibly ornate and wild story. I'll never be able to summarize it, but where, you know, you have these future LA and you have these, you know, kind of skater punk kids and you have these hacker computer types who have figured out how to live in this thing called the metaverse. And they're, you know, people who like underground who, you know, will do programming for this, you know, alternate world. And the mafia somehow gets involved and Stevenson somehow, you know, and again, my memories are really vague, but he somehow ties like Sumerian mythology into this whole story, you know, and there's this idea that there's this, I think it's like a data file or something that's like this computer virus that's known as Snow Crash. And it becomes this like sort of addictive thing that, you know, ends up, it kind of infiltrates the metaverse. And like, it's hard to describe because it's such a crazy story. But it just, I guess my point is like, it was, you know, you're reading this book in the early 90s, you have to kind of picture it with all these ideas that sound just totally out of whack. And yet here we are in 2024, you know, and people wearing these goggles and logging into the metaverse and people have avatars online and in these virtual worlds that are being created. I mean, it's being talked about right now, you know, most of the major tech companies, Apple and Elon Musk and, you know, Facebook or what is now Meta, they're all trying to like compete with each other to release products that will put us into this quote unquote metaverse. And here's Neal Stephenson back in the early 90s, wrote a whole book about this stuff and also found a way to weave in like ancient mythologies and a guy delivering pizza on a skateboard, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and I know there's a part of it, like there's a, this is very vague, but there's like a Noah's Ark kind of thing that has a whole bunch of like refugees who are off the coast of California. They're trying to get into the United States and there's somehow that's involved in the plot. And like, there's just a lot in this book that like is still in the news today. And there's something really incredible about that. So it's a kind of book that I wouldn't mind going back and reading, kind of seeing what it looks like and what it feels like now, but it is, it's got to be considered one of the most, you know, speculative and predictive, you know, science fiction titles in the last like 30, 40 years. I mean, that book is still being talked about today. I guarantee you, I haven't looked at this, but I guarantee you, you could look on like Wired magazine and you'd probably see articles about this book from that time period. And you probably see articles about it from this time period. You know, it just had this sort of prophetic feel. And I remember the book being big and kind of messy and, you know, not necessarily, it was confusing and maybe not the greatest writing, but it almost doesn't matter because it was just so like, gosh, it's just so ahead of its time. I mean, there's something remarkable about that, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite an achievement, you know, like, you know, to be able to do that. I just saw today, I think it was today or yesterday, an article, which is exactly what you said, except about a different early book by Neal Stephenson called The Diamond Age, which think you and I might have read. Yeah. And there was a whole article that just came out. I just saw it in the last 24 hours about how that book essentially predicted chatbots and, like, you know, AI, you know, back in like 93 or something or 94.
Yeah, he was really tapped into something. I don't know what he was smoking or what he was, reading at that time. But, you know, to be very much still in the conversation, what is it, 30 years later, 30, 35 years later, whatever it is, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and just like, again, the you know, that's a whole different wing of impressive, you know, just like the intellect, the foresight, the vision, the understanding of technology, and it's just, those books are really interesting to talk about, kind of like where we're sitting right now, John, because it's an example of, you know, just because of our age and, like, you know, our journey in science fiction and stuff, like, you know, it's one thing for us to read that Snow Crash as young 20-somethings ourselves 25 years ago or something, and then, but to go back and read it now would be a totally different experience in almost every way imaginable.
Yeah.
And just the fact that these guys wrote, science fiction writers, and, you know, we don't have a lot of women in here yet, but, like, science fiction writers, men and women, that's sort of like part of their ambition. And that, and sometimes they write books like this that really just kind of see into the future. And then, so it becomes this thing that you can, you know, it's a one experience in at one time, and it's a totally different experience 30 years later.
Yeah.
You know, which is just kind of really wild also. But I just want to say, like, do you think we should take, like, a technology break here?
Yeah, I was going to say that too. It's time to take a quick break, and then we'll come right back. But by the way, I do have two women coming up, so there are going to be some women writers that are talked about here today.
Well, good for you. I actually don't have them on my list, but there's one I'm going to talk about later at least. But anyway.
Yeah, so let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and keep going.
Okay.
Okay, Jude, we're back. I'd like you to know that I now have a fresh pint of Guinness in my hand.
Wow, nice.
I'm enjoying for the second part of this discussion. It's a gift from my friend Kurt, by the way, Kurt with a C. So, Kurt, if you ever hear this episode, this pint's on you, and I appreciate it, my friend. Anyway, we are back to you. What is another science fiction title that you would like to discuss for our listeners?
Well, I'm going to throw out four titles, and I could throw out many other titles, but John, we cannot do this episode without talking about Philip K. Dick.
Absolutely. You
know? Philip K. Dick is, like, we've talked about him many times on the show. We've threatened to do a whole episode on his work. Maybe that won't be necessary now. I don't know. Anyway, he has so much work. He had so much work. It's hard to compass it all anyway. But, you know, when you talk about classic science fiction, you know, I would venture to say that this is the science fiction writer that you and I have had by far the most fun talking about and sharing his books and laughing at his totally crazy science fiction books. It's Philip K. Dick. I mean, wouldn't you agree with that? That's like the guy that you and I keep coming back to and have the most fun with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm probably stealing a little of your thunder here, but you mentioned the 90s before. And I remember, for some reason, they were, like, reissuing a lot of his books during that time. So I remember you and I going back and forth, like, when a new reissue would come out, because a lot of his books came out in the 60s, 70s, 80s, I think. And then I don't know what it was. It was just the movies or something, but there was a resurgence in his popularity, and they were putting out new books left and right. And we both at one point worked in bookstores, so we would see kind of new titles. And I remember laughing at some of the actual titles and descriptions of some of these books. So yeah, we were right in there when he was enjoying that resurgence in popularity.
Right. Like We Can Build You, for example.
Right. Yeah. You know, Galactic Popular.
One of his most famous works, so I'm going to talk about in a second. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Which is one of the best titles in the history of science fiction, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
I don't know. It's so hard to, you know, Philip Dick is a whole world unto himself. But he was a guy that, like, did it all, John. Like, he had the books that were set in sort of more almost – so maybe slightly ahead of us contemporary times. In one particular city, he had books where people went to other planets, fought aliens. He had he did everything, you know?
Yep.
And he had this way, and he was extremely prolific and inventive, and the crazier the better. You know, he had all these kind of bananas concepts for stories, some of which became very famous, like the film Total Recall, for example, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where you can, like, you know, buy memories of, like, an experience you didn't live. That comes from a Philip K. Dick story. Minority Report, Tom Cruise,
where
the guy can, you know, there's, like, these prescient beings that can see crimes that didn't happen yet, and you can arrest people for crimes that didn't take place yet. The Man in the High Castle.
Pre-crime.
Right. the Man in the High Castle, you know, which imagines the U.S. losing to the Nazis. You know, and having in the United States divided between is like the Nazis and the Japanese, you know, you know, and then most famously his short novel called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which became the film Blade Runner, which is a seminal science fiction movie, Ridley Scott with Harrison Ford, etc. That's a really kind of like, you know, legendary science fiction film. And I think that's how I believe that's how I found my way to Philip K. Dick's work in the early 1990s. I was in the Army. I'm pretty sure I might have seen the film Blade Runner, which came out when you and I were like 11 years old. I remember seeing reviews of that movie. It got like really panned critically when you and I were like 12, 13 years old. I was never really exposed to it until my like early 20s, and I became like a huge fan of the movie, and I believe that's how I started reading Philip K. Dick. I want to say, I'm really hazy on this, but I want to say a friend of mine that I knew in the service was also into science fiction, was also into Blade Runner. We watched it together, and he had one of those, you know, mass market novelizations of the movie, you know, which were, or like it was like the Philip K. Dick story, but like marketed like the movie. Mm-hmm. And he lent it to me and I read it. And I remember being a little bit disappointed how different the book was from the film. Cause there's a lot of similarities. Like the character's name is Deckard and there's replicants and all that stuff. But there's bigger questions in the book than there are in the film. And there's like, you know, a whole different aspect to the book. Originally I was disappointed about that, but now I actually think it's better. You know, now that I've had some time, but how do I want to say this? Like, you know, it was he to me is like the prime example of an imagination that he just let go without limitations, imagining different scenarios like the ones I've already described and many, many, many other ones. And he would do it in book after book. And he was famous for being kind of a train wreck personally. He was also kind of a drug addict. And a lot of his – as he continued to write science fiction novels, they became more and more speculative. He actually got into, as you know, some very interesting topics and questions the more he wrote, things of a more existential or even theological nature, you know, went all the way down into that rabbit hole, but a lot of it was connected with his drug use and tripping out on weird drugs and stuff like that. Yeah. So you got to take all of his work with like a grain of salt. But when it comes to a prolific imagination and a vast range of extraordinary ideas, also combined with acerbic wit and like a hilarious kind of dry sense of humor, that would turn up and, you know, we'd have like aliens saying like ridiculous wisecracks and stuff like that. Just really funny and enjoyable stuff. he was not like, he was interesting because he was so skilled at writing these books that, you know, when he was not admired from a literary perspective in his lifetime, but the longer his books kind of hung around and the more prescient they seemed as time went on, he gained respect not only for like, you know, for like his vision, but also just for like literary reasons, you know, like the foresight and the way he could just kind of like delve into weird concept after weird concept after weird concept. His reputation kind of grew into, and now he's considered one of the great, you know, sort of imaginative writers in literary history, you know?
Yeah.
But he certainly wasn't revered like that when he was alive, you know? And anyway, so people who are interested in science fiction, if you've got to read Philip K. Dick. You got to read kind of almost as much of him as you can because his books are a screaming good time. They're very speculative. They're very imaginative. Some of them are very confusing and like trippy. Some of them aren't. But there's just a – if you go down the Philip K. Dick rabbit hole, there's something in there for everybody. There's tons of books out there, tons of short stories. There's like 5 or 6 volumes of his collected short stories. They're crazy interesting. I just want to mention a few titles. I'm not going to go through plot descriptions of each of these titles, but some of the titles that I read in that period, like those 4 or 5 years that you and I were like really exploding with his books and batting. It's just kind of like for you and me, it's like really tied up with our memories of this particular genre, right? Like we had a ball, you know, and we still do to this day, but like in that period, we were just kind of knocking Philip K. Dick books over the net, like, you know, tennis, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember that. And that's sort of fond memories for me. But Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The classic story behind Blade Runner, where this guy, Rick Deckard, plays a bounty hunter whose job is to track down these escaped replicants who are like androids who have escaped from this prison colony off Earth and come to Earth, and they're trying to find their maker. And he's hired to like track them down kind of like gumshoe style and kill them. That's an amazing book. There's a book called The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, which is kind of too hard to get into, but it has to do with this guy who's like on another planet, and he's discovered that somebody has created I don't know what the word is, but like he's found a way to like grant you kind of everlasting life through an aerosol spray, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and he's trying to like crack the mystery of that. You can tell from the title, The Three Stigmata. It's where Dick was kind of getting into more speculative ideas. Fascinating book. The Man in the High Castle, I've already mentioned, which it's kind of like one of the ultimate examples of alternate history, picturing the United States, but in a post-World War II that's very different from the one that actually happened. But then there's like a whole mystery around a missing person and stuff. And that it's very sort of spy thriller also, very imaginative, very good. And there's a much more obscure Philip K. Dick book. I think you can find it still, but it's called Counter Clock World. And I remember reading that and just being so impressed with it because the whole story is about a society or a world in which people – it's a little bit like Benjamin Button and F. Scott Fitzgerald. It's where people live their lives in reverse. So you're born in the grave and you have to kind of dig out of the grave and you're elderly. And then you kind of like live your life, you know, in the opposite direction. And you have limited time until you turn into an infant, a babbling infant who can't do anything. And there's a whole science fiction book around that with the lots of cops and robbers and stuff. Crazy. Really fun. You know, I don't know what else I can really say about Philip K. Dick, but I did want to say in this episode, like, you know, you got to read Philip K. Dick if you want to, if you're going anywhere near science fiction, you know, he cannot be missed, you know? So I had to bring him up.
Absolutely. And he just has some of the most creative and inventive titles. Even you just look at the titles of some of his books alone, you know, now Wait for Last Year. Like we said, Galactic Pot Healer, The Game Players of Titan, and a book that I actually just reread recently, which I was going to mention in the context of you bringing him up, which is called, famously called, Flow My Tears, the policeman said.
Yeah.
Which is a line.
That's from a classic poem. Too.
Yeah. That's a line from a poem or something. But, and having read that really recently, it was just another one of these really wild and inventive stories where it involves like a popular TV host who, you know, millions of people watch him every night, and he takes some kind of drug, I think. And he spends the night with like a prostitute, and he's drugged, and he ends up the next morning. And it's like, he not only does he not exist now, he never existed at all. Even though he has this like, you know, hugely popular show that everybody watches, he gets like 30 million viewers every night. So he wakes up and nobody knows who he is, you know. And it's the rest of the book is just kind of this mystery trying to unravel sort of what happened to him. There's always a couple of things, like again and again in his books, like you mentioned the drug use. Drug use is a major part of his life, and there's almost every mm-hmm. book has some kind of drug in it that does something weird to somebody, or, you know,
right.
That's a major aspect of his writing. And then the other is there's almost always some kind of, well, I guess I was going to say some kind of police state, but more broadly, like he wrote a lot. He had a very sort of paranoid vision of like the state or like yeah. the authority. So there's always somebody listening. Mm-hmm. This book, Flow My Tears, the policeman said, you can't trust him. You know, you just have to assume everybody, the state or the government is listening to everything you say all the time, you know? And another book that we didn't bring up, but one of his more well-known books that was also developed into a movie, really a memorable movie, which is called A Scanner Darkly, where there's mm-hmm. there's this drug on the streets that can split your personality, and there's a policeman who ends up, you know, taking the drug, and then he ends up sort of like, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of like spying on or narking on his own self, but he doesn't realize it because he has this sort of like split personality. It's just like it's nuts. So, you know, incredibly imaginative, incredibly weird, but like, you know, again, like Stevenson in a way, you know, you read these books and there are many aspects of what they're writing about that feel contemporary, you know? So it's just,
yeah,
those books are really a lot of fun, and they're so wild and inventive. You could just almost pick up any one of them and have a good time with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're kind of fun. First and foremost, I want to emphasize that none of them are real long. Some of them are harder to get through than others, but none of them, especially the spacier ones, you know, but none of them are real long. He was kind of like a pulp writer. Like he just kind of, you know, blasted them out, something like Elmore Leonard or something like that. And, you know, fueled by all these drugs he was taking or whatever, but there's like a real kind of glory or beauty to that output as well. Like there's just, you know, there's endless titles from Philip K. Dick, and they're all, you know, they all got something that's just like, you know, head turning. And you made a very good point to bring up kind of the paranoid aspect of his work. Paranoid is the right word, or like conspiracy. There was a lot of that hanging over his stuff. And, you know, he very famous. I've read at least one biography of him, and he very famously, like, you know, distrusted everybody, the government, his ex-wives in particular. They were all out to get him, you know, like, and pardon me. And that's another, you know, kind of enjoyable aspect of his work, because there's always a ring of truth to some of that stuff. Not all truth, but like, you know, there's a paranoid quality of our very society, and, you know, and that never seems to change, you know, with technologies or time advancing or stuff like that. You know, who's listening to who, who's spying on who, you know. And all this stuff was there in Philip K. Dick's books, you know, like many, many years ago, you know. So it's just like, you know, sometimes they really feel like timely, you know, even though they're not.
Absolutely. I mean, just imagine what he would have made of the internet, or the fact that there are people who have learned how to like look at you through your camera that every computer right. comes with.
And drones or.
Yeah, drones. It's just it's nuts.
You know, well, a lot of the things that we live with now, John, feel like they came out of his mind, you know.
That's right. That's right. And that's what makes so many of these books and writers memorable, is that they invented or created things that we're either seeing now or we're on the cusp of. You know, if we ever figure out how to travel through time, you know, H.G. Wells was writing about that in the turn of the century, the last turn of the century. You know, So anyway, speaking of British writers, you know, we'll stay on that for 600, Alex. You mentioned that we hadn't mentioned any women writers yet. I'm about to break that streak right now. One of the most interesting books on my list, and that has stayed with me, and this title was also developed into a film that became quite popular. It's a book called Children of Men, and it was written by P.D. James. And there's lots of interesting things about this book, aspects of this book. Well, one is that P.D. James is not known at all for writing science fiction. In fact, as far as I know, this is the only quote-unquote science fiction title of her entire output, and her output is large. I wanted to bring this up because it's a great book, but also because she's just such a great writer. She's come up from time to time on the show, but we haven't talked that much about her. She's known primarily as a mystery writer. She may have come up in that episode where we talked about mysteries. I can't remember. Didn't we have a mystery episode?
Not per se. We had a thriller episode.
Okay. Well, anyway, she would come up if we had a mystery episode.
definitely. Yeah.
P.D. James is just a great writer in general. She's known for, as I said, being a writer of really, really well, elegantly written, compelling mysteries. She's got a whole series of involving this one character, this inspector named Adam Dalgleish. And I've read a few of those books, and they've all been just tremendously satisfying. But for some reason, and I'm sure she's explained this, you could probably go back and research it. But once again, you know, the intern, you know, I emailed the intern
failed us
about this, and I got the, you know, out of office response. So,
you know. Man, we gotta sack that.
Yeah. Anyway,
slouch.
I should have done a little more research, but for whatever reason, she was inspired to write this story that's, you know, basically, if you had to fit it into a genre, you'd fit it into science fiction, because it's about kind of it's a speculation about the future of humanity. It's a story about a time in the future when, and I don't think it's specified why this is, but all men have gone sterile. So there's now no longer any way to continue the human race. You know, eventually we're going to hit the last person and the human race is going to die out. So that's part of the setting for this book. It also kind of speculates a future where there's kind of like, you know, sort of like one large sort of global society, and it's become sort of a police state, as, you know, often happens in these books. And this book features on a kind of a quiet, mild-mannered professor who's a bit of a loner. He had a family at one point, but he's sort of estranged from his family. But he happens to be the cousin of this person who's become like the ruler of the state. The head of the state is kind of like dictating, is essentially a dictator. And he happens to be a cousin of his. So he's like a family relation. And then he has, I'm trying to remember. Oh boy. I can't really remember, but he gets introduced to some people who are part of a resistance movement who are trying to resist some of what's going on in this future society. You know, like basically all immigrants and people, and it takes place in England, and people who are from other places are kind of being thrown into prison camps. And another thing that's happening is that anyone who's over a certain age is given the option to basically commit suicide. You know, there's this program run by the state that's called the Quietus program. And they basically allow anybody who wants to have this kit and basically do away with themselves. So there are many things that are happening in society that there's a whole pocket of people who are resisting some of what's happening. And this professor gets kind of drawn into that group of people who are resisting the state. And they sort of convince him to go to his cousin and ask him if he would, you know, try to appeal to him if he would, you know, put an end to some of these less humane policies. And of course he refuses. And the group decides to basically try to foment a rebellion, you know, against the state. And so he kind of gets involved with this group, and the name of the group is Five Fishes, the Five Fishes, which is sort of interesting. And of course, hanging over this whole story is the fact that, you know, the end of the human race is literally approaching. And it's not a spoiler to say he gets kind of involved in this sort of resistance group, this underground group, and he gets to know this young woman in it, and eventually come to realize that this young woman is pregnant. Nobody knows how, but this woman is pregnant. She's the only woman alive who's carrying a child. And so the rest of the book is about how to, like, sort of protect this young woman and kind of make sure that it doesn't become known that she's pregnant, and how to protect her so that she's actually able to have this baby and therefore provide some hope for the human race. And that's kind of the crux of the book. And they're sort of, you know, they need to kind of protect this woman and somehow find a way to have, you know, and a lot of society is broken down, find a way to have like a healthy birth so that, you know, the human race can survive. So that's basically the story. And it's like just a really fascinating, you know, book about, you know, kind of like an apocalyptic book about like what, you know, what would happen to humanity if they were facing the end of all things, you know, which in some ways you could argue maybe we are in that position with what's going on with the climate and everything. It's just kind of like a brilliant work of sort of speculation. And then it also has this kind of, you know, it's hard to miss. It has this sort of layer over it that's a little bit like almost like a modern, like a retelling of the Christmas story. Not that this baby is going to be the savior of humanity, but in some ways it's literally that, because this baby at all costs needs to be born because they represent hope for the future.
Right.
So it's really interesting that it's the only book like this that she ever wrote, has a lot of really interesting ideas, you know, swirling around, you know, like end of life issues and how to treat, you know, people from other cultures, and, you know, what happens when all of humanity is undergoing like literally a life or death crisis, and, you know, do we turn against each other, or do we try to find ways to protect each other and preserve the future? And so there's a lot of that kind of serious questioning going on, with the characteristic, you know, very thoughtful, very, very elegant prose that P.D. James is known for. It's really an excellent science fiction book, but not in the conventional way. If you're not really a, you know, space opera kind of science fiction person, but you are interested in novels that speculate, you know, into the future, this would be a great one to try, because P.D. James is such a good writer. So, like, I don't remember if you've ever read it, Jude, but it's really a fine book, and it's just, she's such a good writer that she can't help but weave an interesting story.
No, that was a good summary of the book. I've never read it. I've read P.D. James before. So I know that, like, most of her books are not at all like that kind of thing. So,
no.
You know, as you pointed out, one of the things that's really interesting about it is just how much of a, you know, kind of a aberration, you know, like it was from the rest of her career, you know. Totally. And it'd be really interesting to, you know, learn more about where why that happened, and, you know, like why she didn't like decide to come back to it or anything like that, because she kind of – after that, she's deceased now. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah, she was very elderly. She lived a very long life and wrote for almost all the way to the end of it.
That's right.
And you're right. Her books are, you know, she was like a classic, you know, old school, refined, prim, you know, little British lady who could really, really write, you know, could really write prose in a very crisp and particularly British and elegant manner. And that's the way most of her mysteries were written too. Even though she sort of trucked in death, she was like this very refined lady, you know?
Yeah.
And she, you know, she was interesting to listen to in interviews and stuff because she was like very, very elegant even about the way she would talk about what she did for a living. But right. this book is such a you know, outlier, you know. And, it, of course, it was turned into an outstanding film by Alfonso Cuarón, right. you know, from the early 2000s. And I guess it has some differences from the book, but it's definitely one of those adaptations to film of a novel that really was successful and sort of worth its salt, you know. But no, I never read the book, and it would be really interesting to read because I'm sure it's a very different experience than even the film is, even though the film is excellent. You know, and just some of the, you know, like she, you know, I know she had, she was the type of writer who had like had a lot of, you know, like intelligence and thought behind what she was doing as she sort of executed her craft. And so I'm sure a lot of that same stuff is in the book Children of Men. And there's just lots of profound questions around that concept that you explained, you know. So this is, and obviously it stood out to you. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's really, it's a great book.
Yeah. It's a great recommendation.
So what's next?
Well, okay. So like, I don't think I need to, I have two left. I don't think I need to talk about this at length because it, overlaps a lot, I think, with your previous citation of Snow Crash, but this book had to go on my list. It's the book you referenced it earlier called Neuromancer by William Gibson from the 80s. And basically, you know, this book, I wanted to bring it up, number one, because it definitely was a seminal. It's a seminal science fiction book, no matter how you slice it. It came before Snow Crash. It was one of the first works of fiction, if not the first, that imagine kind of the virtual world of the internet, basically, you know. And it not only, it's not only worth mentioning to for that reason, but also for me, it was like really an eye-opening read, and it stood out in my memory. And I did manage to go back and reread it about 4 or 5 years ago. So I had that experience, unlike with Snow Crash, because I haven't reread Snow Crash. Had the experience of reading it in the 90s, and then I had the experience of reading it again at least 25 years later, you know, because it's kind of become like a classic. But one thing that was really interesting about this book is not very easy to read, and it's not very easy to summarize. And I don't think I'll really have a great success trying to summarize the plot, but it's about this like hacker who is, you know, finds this way to plug in to a another, basically, like I said, this nascent version of like, this is the book that kind of coined the term cyberspace, you know? Mm-hmm. So like the whole story is told in this alternate computerized version of reality from what we know. But this is like the late 80s where it was like, I don't remember the year it came out. I should look this up. But was it the mid 80s or late 80s? It might have been like 84 or 85.
I think it's like mid 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. But it told a whole story basically set in cyberspace or the internet before it existed kind of at all in any way. I mean, I guess it existed going back towards the 70s, depending on how you define what the internet was. But like you said before, not in any way that any of us would experience. Like it was not a part of contemporary life. And this is one of the first science fiction kind of thriller-ish, street, you know, wise, you know, story that's set in this other world. And it's about these like hackers that are like, kind of like you said in Snow Crash. I think it's kind of like a precursor to Snow Crash. Or Snow Crash definitely owes a debt to Neuromancer, because Neuromancer was the book that really, like I said, coined cyberspace and just kind of blasted that whole world into contemporary, you know, awareness. And it was like the first book by this guy, William Gibson.
And also the term cyberpunk.
Cyberpunk, right?
Like, and by the way, it's 1984. That's how early this book was.
Okay. Okay. And the thing about it, it's really interesting. So like when you read it, like I read it in the early 90s again, probably more like 1994, maybe somewhere around the 10th anniversary of it or something like that. I remember reading it. So we were just kind of just at the dawn of like AOL and like, you know, dial up internet access.
Netscape.
Yeah. And this was just kind of coming into people's reality, you know. And to read it and to like sort of go on this, like create, it had a lot to, the plot is, it's actually a very kind of choppy and confusing book. That was my experience when I went back and read it a couple years ago. I thought it was going to be easier to follow the plot and the story of these like hackers that are like competing against each other and like, stealing things and like, you know, peddling access to this or that. And like in this like alternate sort of neon world, it's not very easy to follow. I found it sort of difficult to go back and revisit and kind of follow what's going on. It's written at a kind of a, I guess, you know, one thing is that, you know, writers of this particular stripe were trying to find ways to weave some of these new ideas into their stories. But, you know, I don't think, really, that William Gibson even did a great job of making it very accessible to like average readers. Because when you go back and read it, my experience was it was a tough book to understand. I was like, man, that seemed more opaque than when I read it the first time. But it was such a hit in the face, you know, in terms of like speculation of what was possible. And like you had this whiff of a whole, literally like another world blowing open. And that's what I want to say about this book. Like it, you know, when you read it closer to the time that it dropped, it introduced you to this other facet of existence that you're like, that you knew was artificial, but like people were running in it and killing each other in it and like, you know, trucking in it and stuff and, you know, gangs and stuff like that, guns and stuff like that. And it just had this whole, it was crazy, you know? And that's why I wanted to bring it up, even though you had talked about Snow Crash, because Snow Crash has a lot of similarities. So these are sort of companion books in a way, but Neuromancer came first, you know, and it really kind of blew the doors off that world. I know you read Neuromancer. So one thing I wanted to ask you, John, was I know you haven't read it recently, but like, as far as like a standout book for you, I'm sure it was on your list, but like the, you know, like what do you remember about the experience of reading a book like that? You know, I guess you were talking about it with Snow Crash, but like it was quite an experience. And that's why I wanted to talk about it. Cause that's like what this genre kind of does sometimes, you know?
Yeah, it was that I kind of lumped.
What do you think?
I kind of lumped those two books together in my mind too, even though they're, you know, it was like 8 years separating them. But I do, I remember just being mostly confused by that book. Like, it's just not that,
it's not easy.
And same thing with Snow Crash in a way, like the concepts that they were so far ahead. They were writing about these concepts that you just couldn't even kind of really picture in your mind. And I had trouble doing that, but, so unfortunately I don't remember a lot about reading Neuromancer. I think even at the time, yeah, because we read in the 90s. So at that time, it was already known as kind of a, like a forward-thinking kind of prophetic book.
Yeah.
That was writing about sort of what we were living through at that time in the mid-90s, but had been writing about it at least 10 years earlier. So, but I do remember it being, it's kind of a difficult book to read and understand.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it was hard to leave off my list because it had the feeling of a game changer. It was hard to hang with, and it would be interesting, you know, sort of anybody listening to the show, if they've never read it, kind of coming from where we are now in the world, if you care to take it on, want to go back and kind of check it out, you know, it would be interesting to hear some of those experiences, but I'm not sure we'll get that, but, I just want to end on kind of a funny note. I remember, and I think it was an anniversary edition. It was probably the 10th anniversary, really, based on the time frame I remember reading it. But I remember there was like an introduction, and Gibson was talking about the creation of the character and the world and stuff. And you had to kind of like, you know, in the early days of the internet and stuff, you had to kind of like plug into it. And he invented this kind of like way to do that in the story. And it was called jacking in, like a, you know, like a cable or something, plugging into a cable. And he really wanted to call the novel, when it was first in gestation, Jacked In, until somebody at the publisher was like, it's too close to Jacked Off, you know. So you can't call it that. So like, so that was the end of the title, Jacked In, you know. But I that was like his title for this book, was Jacked In. Anyway, that's kind of a funny story. But you know, the guys, some like blowhard, one of the suits said, like, you know, like, nah, you can't. No, we're not doing that. You know. And anyway, yeah. Neuromancer is a very interesting title too. Neuromancer. Anyway, but that's kind of a funny story. But I couldn't leave it off this list. It was a very, like, you know, just kind of like a blow the doors open kind of book.
Yeah, totally. Like, that's definitely a seminal book in the genre. So I'm glad we kind of worked it in here. So we're getting tight on time, you know, as always happens with these episodes, because, you know, it's just hard to condense so much. I mean, there's so many writers we haven't even touched on, and we never will in an episode like this. But I had two other books that I wanted to bring up. I guess I'll talk about this next one pretty quickly, because I believe I brought it up at least once before in past episodes. I'm pretty sure that I have. But to me, when you talk about contemporary science fiction writers, to me, there's one that stands above all others that I've read in terms of how fascinating his work is. And it's interesting because he only has two books, and they're both collections of stories. So he's never written a full novel. He doesn't write that often, but the stories that I've read, I've only read one of those two books, but it was so incredible that immediately became one of my favorite pieces of science fiction writing I've ever read. And I still think about these stories all the time. It's been a couple of years. That writer is Ted Chiang, and the book is called Exhalation. He has another book of stories. I think it's called Stories of Your Life or something like that. And he wrote a story that was adapted into the movie called Arrival, about the arrival of alien ships on the planet and kind of how human beings sort of deal with that, and how governments try to cooperate in order to interface with these aliens who have a totally different way of thinking and language. Arrival is a great movie, but it also has kind of a part of the plot revolves around a very personal crisis for one of the characters. But Exhalation, I've talked about on the show before. I've talked to you about it at length. These are some of the most mind-blowing science fiction stories that I've ever read. Every single story is fascinating. There are only 9 of them. They have some just reading off some of the titles. One is called The Truth of Fact, The Truth of Feeling. There's one called The Merchant and the Alchemist's Gate. There's one called Anxiety is the Dizziness of Freedom. Another one that I really remember that's a much longer story is called The Life Cycle of Software Objects. I mean, every single one of these stories is absolutely fascinating and about something totally different. And like, I talked about the life cycle of software objects before. It's kind of about this company that creates these sort of like digital pets. Like, speaking of the metaverse, like these kind of creatures that you can kind of, you know, give birth to online and kind of raise online, but they become intelligent, and they start to kind of like develop thoughts and a will of their own. And so it becomes this kind of like extended metaphor for like being a parent, but it's about like kind of raising these sort of digital, citizens, and who eventually, you know, figure out ways to break free of their quote unquote parents. And it's just it just feels incredibly relevant to what we're dealing with right now, because it's basically a story about artificial intelligence. It's just an amazing story. There's another one that kind of, I'm trying to remember here, but there's a man and his daughter who invent this device that allows you, it's a little bit like one of the Black Mirror episodes, Jude, but like this device that allows you to record every single moment of your life and you can go back and access it. But it, at the same time, it also, there's a parallel story involving this like tribe. I believe it might be in like Africa or, but a long, long time ago that develops this technology that we now know as writing with pen and paper. And so it's this fascinating meditation on how we record memories. But one part of it, one thread is set, you know, in the future and another is set way in the past. Kind of like juxtaposes these two, the awareness and the development of these two quote unquote technologies at the same time. It's just, it's fascinating. Like every single one of these stories is just incredibly, like the imagination is just, you know, I don't even really have the words to describe how inventive these stories are, but and how intelligent they are. And I think, I know I've mentioned this to you. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned it on the show too, but at the end of this book, there's like, he has a commentary on each one of the stories and how he came up with the idea and what the story is exploring. You almost never see that in a collection of short stories. And with stories that are this kind of deep and technical, it kind of provides its own commentary in a way without making it, he doesn't give you the way to interpret the story, but he just tells you how the story came about. I don't think you've read this book yet. I said this last time, I'm sure when I talked about it, you got to read this damn book. Like it, to me, this is probably the most impressive science fiction book that I've read, I don't know, in decades. So like I couldn't possibly have, you know, it's interesting because I said he's only written two books. I have no idea if he's going to write another one. He comments a lot. I'm like there was I listened to a long podcast interview with him about artificial intelligence and where we're going with it and whether it's good or bad. And you know, he was just the way he talked about it. It's like, this guy's mind is incredible. And he kind of feels like, you know, I was going to say national treasure, but it goes beyond one nation. Like, you know, we need to be listening to people like this. And anyway, this book, Exhalation, I just can't praise it enough. And if you get any recommendation from me out of this episode, go find that book and read it.
Well, I don't want to make you feel like an idiot, but I'm going to, because not only have I read the book, you gave it to me.
Well, I remember giving it to you. I just couldn't remember if you had read it yet or not, but I guess you have.
Yeah, no, I have read it, and I can relate to the comments you're making on this stuff. I don't know if it hit me in the same way that it hit you, but that, you know, that's not unusual. Like sometimes, you know, sort of the seminal books just kind of strike us in a certain way. It is definitely memorable, though. And like, you know, my memory stinks so much. I read it and didn't retain as much as you seem to have retained, but I do recall each of the stories. I remember how impressed I was by them. I remember how smart they were. I remember the commentary, you know, but I would concur. It's a kind of an amazing book of speculative, really sharp, really intelligent, and interesting science fiction stories. I would say that.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Like, I'm listening to what you're saying, but I just remembered. I mean, this is a book with a story about that's based on a real life example, by the way. There's a story about a talking parrot, a parrot who's really learned how to talk like way beyond what other parrots can do. And the story is him kind of having a dialogue with scientists and trying to convince that it's called The Great Silence, which is fascinating. He's trying to convince the scientists, you know, why do you keep pouring resources into like trying to communicate with other races outside the planet when you don't even know how to communicate with all the other species that are on the planet? And I'm here to tell you, like, this parrot is like, you know, there's so much you haven't explored because you have no idea what we're thinking, you know, meaning the animals. And yeah, like they have this, that's the whole story, is this parrot trying to, and again, apparently it's based on a real life parrot who was the subject of like a experiment over decades. But the point being, like, there's a recent story that I saw somewhere that scientists had, for the first time ever, have kind of like had a back and forth type conversation with whales. So like, it's this whole thing is like the great silence. Like, we have no idea what animals are thinking. So why should we be trying to figure out whether there are other alien races or not? But I mean, that's just a kind of like incredibly imaginative subject that he'll take on in this book. But anyway, you know, it may not, I don't know why it hit me as hard as it did, but I just thought this thing was fascinating.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And people should read it if they're interested in like really sharp and intelligent science fiction stories. They should read it.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to come up with like really like killer science fiction short story collections. Like I said, Philip K. Dick had a ton of them, but there's, you know, it's a pretty short list as far as I know.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up against the 2-hour mark. I just want to point that out. So we may have to kind of figure out what we want to do here.
Well, I'm going to just mention my last one, then I'm going to leave off any others. For those who – can I do that?
Yeah.
For those who are interested in this genre, let me put it this way. If you don't like the kind of pulpy aspect of science fiction or like the kind of dorky quotient of science fiction, said that there's some books that are more like – a fusion of like kind of literary fiction, quote unquote, if you want to get highfalutin, and science fiction. Children of Men is kind of that kind of book. There are some very beautifully written and elegant science fiction books out there. And one of them that I encountered over the last couple of years is a book called Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. Now, Ishiguro is the recipient of the Nobel Prize in Literature, but he's most famous for his novel, The Remains of the Day. So he's kind of like a literary novelist. He is an unusual case because he is a Japanese man who was supplanted to London when he was very young. His parents moved them to London. So he's an Englishman and also Japanese. And he has many excellent books. You know, they're like some of them are kind of challenging. He's also famous for kind of another quasi-science fiction novel called Never Let Me Go. In which people were kind of like harvested basically for their organs in that story. And it follows these young people. But Clara and the Sun is a book that came out a couple years ago. It's a really good short book that's elegantly written, beautifully written. And it has to do with something called an AF, not an AI, which is an artificial friend. So it's like an android. And the book opens – the book is famously told – or I don't know if it's famous, but it's – the book is eloquently told from the point of view of the artificial android. So the book opens with this female artificial, you know, female sort of built artificial android, artificial friend called an AF in the book in like a store in like the near future, kind of waiting to be bought by a customer. And in this story, everything is so you get everything from the point of view of the artificial being. That's what's so effective and interesting about this particular story. And what happens in this story is that she is waiting to be bought. She is eventually bought by a woman who has decided to buy her because part of her reason for existence is to be like a friend to somebody who, for whatever reason, doesn't have a lot of friends. So this woman brings her home to befriend and be a companion for her daughter who has like kind of a terminal illness. So her daughter's like a teenager and she has this terminal illness, and Clara, the artificial friend, her job is to go home and befriend this young woman who's going through this terrible illness and only has so many years to live. So she goes to her house, which is kind of in the country, and she ingratiates herself with the girl in the story. And eventually, you know, things go awry. There's like a boy involved who shows the girl attention and then kind of ditches her and stuff. And Clara decides she doesn't like that and decides to sort of take matters into her own hands, etc. And then along the way, the reason why it's called Clara and the Sun is because what's a great part of the appeal of the book is that Clara spends a lot of time in the book trying to figure out her existence, who invented her, why she's there, and ways that she connects and does not connect with the human race, and she develops this theory about the deity of the sun. So she spends a lot of time, because the sun kind of fascinates her, so she spends a lot of time contemplating the sun, and that sort of works its way into the plot as well. Beautifully written book, highly intelligent, fascinating read. It kind of blows right through. You kind of blow right through it. And by one of the great masters working today, Ishiguro, in, he's not for everybody, but he's one of the great writers working today. And it's like an example of a science fiction book that's like written at a really high level, and it's very fascinating and definitely gets my recommendation. So I did want to mention Clara and the Sun.
Yeah, I really want to read that one. You've talked about that before on the show. But, you know, Nobel Prize winner writing a book about an artificial intelligence. I mean, that kind of sells me right there. But I also,
yeah, a little brainer.
I've talked about on the show before, you know, I picked up Remains of the Day, didn't think I would love it at all. It became my favorite book of the year that I read it that year. So,
mm-hmm.
And I've read his book called The Buried Giant, which is also an interesting book. It's a strange book, but quite interesting. Set in kind of a, like the medieval period of in the UK, in Britain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not going to have time to kind of dive into this book, but I want to at least mention it. It's the other book on my list that was written by a female author. Her name is Mary Doria Russell. And it's a very well-known and popular science fiction novel called The Sparrow. And mm-hmm. It spawned at least one sequel. But she's written actually many other books. I was looking at her profile, and she recently wrote a pair of books about Wyatt Earp and like what happened at the OK Corral, which is interesting. But, you know, her novel, The Sparrow, is one of the most interesting and deep and profound science, you know, deep science fiction books that I've read. And it's a novel of first contact. It's, again, it goes, swings back to, you know, a story set in deep space, at least part of it is. But this novel has a lot of religious themes and questions kind of wove through the book. Because what it imagines is that, you know, there's a Jesuit priest who is being kind of interviewed by church authorities in the beginning of the book. And you come to find out that he was part of a mission that went out to kind of discover there is a signal that was picked up on the planet Earth a long time ago. And, you know, there's an official, you know, voyage sent out by like NASA or by an international coalition. But this priest, who is actually a linguist, he kind of ended up hearing about it. And like the Jesuits, Society of Jesus, you know, who were known for centuries to kind of, you know, go to far-flung places and do missionary work. They kind of put together their own. Somehow they put together their own kind of like a mission to go and try to make contact with this other race. And one of the interesting things about this book is that the signal that the Earth receives is not like a bunch of data. It's not plans to build a spaceship. It's not like a radio signal. It's music, which is a fascinating idea. So yeah. They pick up on the signal and they realize it's music from another culture. So anyway, there's a Jesuit priest who is kind of part of this sort of like secretive mission, and they make contact with this other race on another planet. And most of the book is kind of a flashback to what happened, because he's now being investigated for his role in what happened. And, you know, it's a very interesting first contact story that delves into a lot of very deep questions, both spiritual and scientific. Great book, fascinating, totally original. And it's one of these books that you just read and you're just thinking about for a long time after. So it had to be mentioned, this book, The Sparrow. If any of that sounds appealing, or if you're somebody who appreciates, you know, kind of science fiction that asks deeper questions about not just space or another race, but about us as a species, that would be a good one to try.
Yeah, that's you gave me that book, and I actually have not read it yet. But that's always been kind of on the corner of my eye. That's a great one. You know, that's a really considered has a great reputation.
I don't know of any science fiction story like it, because it brings in this kind of like the Jesuit aspect and kind of missionary work, and there's a lot in it about linguistics, because the priest is like a master of languages, and then there's also a kind of a moving portrait of a long time marriage, because there's a husband and a wife that are part of the mission, and the whole thing has this like doomed and tragic feel, because you know from the outset that the mission did not go well and was kind of a tragedy. And so you kind of go through the book the book sort of explains what happened. So it's really unique.
Yeah. I'll never forget when you first gave it to me, John, you said like, Jude, I got three words for you: Jesuits in space. And I was like, we start laughing. And of course our father was a Jesuit for a long time, you know, and I was like, I'm in, you know, like,
exactly. Yeah. Jesuits in space.
Jesuits in space.
I mean, that's,
that was memorable right there.
That's a lot of the book. So
that's an example of the kind of fun we have with these books, though, just to wrap it up. Like, you know, it was the speculation and the crazy ideas and stuff has always been very fun for us. So in a way, this is like a personal – this is why I was never too worried about this topic, because it's in a way it's kind of a personal episode with us almost, because we just – I don't know. I keep saying it, but we had a lot of good time – a lot of fun times knocking around these books over the years.
Well, that's for sure. Yep. And that kind of brings us to the end of our discussion. I mean, there's so many writers and books that we didn't bring up, but there's no way you can cover it all.
No, I'm not even going to try on my list. You know, let's just wrap it up.
Anyway, so that's at least gives you some interesting recommendations to try whether you're familiar with those books or not. But we're going to kind of need to wrap things up quickly here, Jude. Do you want to just tell us really quickly what's in the on deck circle in terms of what you're going to read next?
Well, I'm going to push back on that. I mean, it's our show. We can go on as long as we want, you know, like, I'm just kidding. But, yeah. So in terms of the next book I'm going to read, I'm going to zag really heavily, but not from this particular topic. I had an awareness. I said it earlier in the show that I didn't have any women on my list. And I saw, there are women science fiction writers out there, but I just haven't read a lot of them, I guess. So I felt that was kind of a needed addressing. So originally I was going to try to read it for this episode, but it doesn't matter. But the book I'm going to read next happens to be, and I'm really looking forward to this, it's by a black woman who writes fantasy and science fiction. She is Nigerian in descent, but was actually born in Cincinnati, Ohio. So Xavier University.
Nice.
Country. She's a well-known science fiction writer in our contemporary time. Her name is, I'm not going to say it correctly, it's Nnedi Okorafor. So her first name is Nnedi, two N's, and then Okorafor is exactly as it sounds. Okorafor. Anyway, she's written a lot of well-known science fiction books. Most famously, there's a book she wrote called Who Knows Death? Who Fears Death is probably her most well-known book. The book I'm going to read next is kind of more of a novella. It's a short novel. It's called Remote Control. And I'm just going to bring the description in the book is very brief. So I'm going to read it and then I'll just kind of leave it there, John. But just this is going to be my way of saying what I'm reading next. So Remote Control by Nnedi Okorafor. And the description is as follows. The day Fatima got her name. I'm sorry. Start again. The day Fatima forgot her name, Death with a capital D paid a visit. From this moment on, she would be known as Sankofa, a name that meant nothing to anyone but her, the only tie to her family and her past. Her touch is death, and with a glance, a town can fall. And she walks alone, except for her fox companion, searching for the object that came out of the sky and gave itself to her when the meteors fell, and when she was yet unchanged, searching for answers. But is there a greater purpose for Sankofa now that death is her constant companion? So that's the book I'm reading, Remote Control. So I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Wow, that sounds wild.
Yeah. So it's really, I think she has this, it appears to me, I haven't read her before, she has this way of fusing her African heritage, first of all, you know, science fiction elements, like things falling out of the sky and meteors and whatnot, and then a mythology that may be very heavily based, I don't know, I'm not an expert on African traditions, but it sounds like something she has invented herself. So I'm all ears, you know, it's going to be wild.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. You know, we should bring up that there's one writer who a science fiction writer is very, very well respected and well known. I think she's from this country, but I could be wrong. But I've never read her. I've always been very curious. Her name is Octavia Butler. She's got a number of books. And fascinatingly to me, given some of what I've said on this episode, you know, there are a number of them that are named after famous parables of Jesus. Like there's a parable of the sower. I know that. There's another one called the parable of the talents. And I don't know anything about these books, but she's been writing for a long time and I know is highly, highly regarded in the area of science fiction. The other thing is, what on this same topic or along these same lines, one of the most popular science fiction writers in America right now is a woman named N.K. Jemisin, who I'm sure you've heard of.
Yeah.
She has has several series of science fiction books that are, like, you know, award-winning and highly regarded and have sold a ton of copies. I think I read somewhere she's the only person ever to win, like, 3 straight Hugo Awards for, like, 3 years in a row. So that's pretty incredible. So that's another writer. Yeah,
worth mentioning.
Definitely worth mentioning, and I hope I can get to some of these books, you know, before I kick it, you know. So,
well, something not to, you know, prolong this, but like just a sort of an on-air production kind of thing. Somebody like Octavia Butler, though, John, that's like you and I have talked in the past, and now we're just going off to we're in production, pre-production or whatever. You and I have talked in the past about possibly doing episodes like that we kind of gave the name Undiscovered, where we both read up on a writer that neither of us has read, but probably should have, you know?
Right.
And Octavia Butler is an example of that kind of writer to me. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah.
You know, let's read a few of her books and compare notes or something like that. Yeah, but, that you know, we'll see.
That'd be pretty wild.
Yeah. So anyway,
We're going to get to what our next episode is going to be here in a second. I'll just mention really quick the next book that I'm going to read, which is I've had this mapped out for a little while, and this is a book I've been circling around for a while. I'm really looking forward to this, but you're going to be like, what the hell?
I probably won't be too surprised.
Well, it's a book called The Anarchy, and it's by a British writer named William Dalrymple, who's someone I've actually read before. I think I've read 2 or 3 of his books.
Wow.
But he's a British writer, writes a lot about travel and writes a lot about India because he's lived in India for a long time. So this is like a 500 or 600 page, the big meaty paperback that I have. And it's a history of the East India Trading Company, like the British, you know, company that basically came into, it was established to basically essentially plunder India of all of its resources, you know,
like, right.
So it's a history of the interaction basically between British and India and that whole history between them, which I thought, I think that's going to be fascinating. So it's called, it has a subtitle. Let me see here. Yeah, it's called The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Trading Company. So it's like this big, thick history.
I actually love that idea. That's probably going to be really interesting.
Oh, I think it's going to be. Yeah, I think it's going to be pretty incredible. And Dalrymple is a writer I've actually liked a lot. I've read the 2 books I can think of that I read from him. They're both fascinating. One was called City of Jinns, like D-J-I-N-N, which is a, I don't remember which language, but it's a word for spirit. So I think it's, yeah, it's about
spirit.
His life spent in, I'm trying to remember whether it was Bombay or New Delhi. I can't remember the city, which is awful, but it was a book about his time living there. And then he wrote another book, fascinating book called Nine Lives, which is about nine different people who practiced different religions in Asia. So whether they were Hindus or Jains or Buddhists, you know, there's just a profile of these nine different people and what they believed in that part of the world. I thought it was just utterly fascinating. But anyway,
this book, that guy's for you, John. What year is that book from?
It's only the
Anarchy.
It's like in the last 5 or 6 years, I think. It's not that
okay. I just wasn't sure.
Or maybe within 10 years, but it's fairly recent. So
well, that's a good one.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. So that, you know, the last thing to do is just tell our listeners what we're going to be talking about the next time we record one of these episodes, and what's that going to be, dude? Do you remember?
Yeah, like, and I don't know what to call this yet. I'm gonna give it a title, but I don't think it's the right one. So the subject is like the craziest or the most memorable short stories that we've read. We're gonna try to. We're not talking about collections. We're gonna we've done at least one episode on kind of the craft of the short story. We're not really gonna unpack the form per se. The idea was to – there are short – like we both read tons of story collections before from writers from around the world. You just mentioned Jhumpa Lahiri from India and whatever.
Yeah.
But there are some stories you read that just stay with you, and I'm talking about individual stories. You talked about a couple from Ted Chiang that just – you know, they don't sound like they're going to leave you anytime soon.
No.
There's a few I can think of off the top of my head that like I'm not going to forget them. And I want to kind of go through what we're going to do is try to archive our memories. You know, that's going to be fun. And talk about some of the really kind of like the greatest short stories we've read for one reason or another, or the ones that really impact us. So I don't want to say craziest. I don't want to say the best. Just the ones that for some reason out of all the stories we've read, you just have not forgotten them. I can think of a couple, and I want to see if I can come up with a couple more. And so that's our topic for next time.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. You know, we're going to come up with some corkers. So
like, yeah, the ones I can think of, I definitely want to talk about. And we haven't really talked about them as individual works before, at least the ones I can think of. So, you know, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, I can think of a few already that are like, you know, ripe in my memory to add to this list, but that's for next time. We've gone a little long, but I think it's been a fun discussion, and I hope you all have enjoyed it. So that's episode 65 in the books for the, so to speak, for the Book Exchange
right.
podcast. And great discussion, Jude. Great time as always talking with you and kicking around science fiction.
Yeah, it was fun. Let's do it again. So thank you everybody for listening.
Take care, everyone. See you next time.
Bye.